From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Pride and protest in San Francisco as the city prepares to host the Beijing Olympic torch ceremony next week. China's crackdown in Tibet complicates the run-up to the Games and causes worry in the Bay Area's Tibetan community.
It's nice to see that, you know, whenever we have sad things happening in Tibet, that, okay, yeah, we have a community outside that's standing in solidarity with our suffering people in Tibet.
Also, a six-year-old tennis prodigy from Sacramento perfects his serve in France. And who makes the best espresso in the West?
Competitive baristas, you know, drinking beer, will get into debates about, you know, grinder on the right side or grinder on the left side, and various other things that, you know, most people would consider to be absolutely trivial, but we obsess over it.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. In an ideal world, the Olympic Games conjure up images of international camaraderie and world peace. But we don't live in that world, and as Beijing prepares to host the Summer Games in August, anger over China's recent crackdown in Tibet spilled into the streets of San Francisco this week. Critics of China's human rights record turned out to protest as San Francisco prepares to host the Beijing Olympic torch relay through the city streets next week. It's the only city in North America chosen to host the torch, but city supervisors rained on that parade this week, passing a resolution blasting China. Reporter Kelly Wilkinson is covering the story. And Kelly, give us a sense of what's been happening this week in the city.
This week, the city released details of the route that the torch is going to take through the city and who the torchbearers are, who's going to be carrying the torch. And so protesters are putting their plans together for some very large-scale protests that are likely to draw thousands of protesters.
So what exactly are they protesting? Are they protesting the torch? Are they protesting China, the Olympics, what?
Well, that's really the question. The question is, how appropriate is it, or is it appropriate at all, to link the torch to China and its politics and policies? So on one side of that debate, you have people saying the Olympics aren't Chinese. It's an international event, and there's more appropriate ways, relevant ways to protest and point out some of China's human rights policies. On the other hand, you have people who say the torch is such an icon and so powerful and represents all of these ideals of unity and humankind coming together and fair play that this offers a perfect chance to focus attention on China's human rights, associations with Darfur, all kinds of its treatment of Falun Gong. So those are the kind of protesters who are going to be out next week.
Well, and all of this debate and the resolution passed this week was sponsored by San Francisco Supervisor Chris Daley. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The history of the Olympics and our political history are necessarily intertwined. The Olympics are that big of an event. You know, they're a part of our culture and our politics.
Kelly Wilkinson, I guess he kind of has a point. I mean, it's hard to separate the Olympics from politics. On the other hand, this is really about the torch and the athletes.
Yeah, Supervisor Daley does recognize, and he says this is symbolic. I mean, this is a symbolic resolution, but he also says the torch is coming here to San Francisco, so he feels that San Francisco should take a stand.
Can't pass up the opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what about the athletes? I mean, have you talked with any of them, and how are they feeling about the conflict?
Well, people do recognize that this is to be expected to a certain extent in San Francisco. And supporters say that, you know, the city's giving supporters and the torchbearers all kinds of reassurances that they'll really be protected and that the city will make room for supporters and protesters of the torch. One woman I talked with, Ann Cribbs, is a former medalist and is a big Olympic supporter. And she says maybe it's appropriate that politics and sports do mix because it gives us a chance to have a conversation we might not otherwise have.
You know, everybody has their own Olympic story, and everybody you meet on the street can tell you about a favorite athlete, and it's different for everybody. And I think that's how the torch will be. Everybody will bring their own experience to it.
So she's kind of keeping her wits about her, not getting too bent out of shape about it. Give us a sense, Kelly, quickly, of the journey that this torch is taking before it gets to San Francisco. How's it getting here?
Well, in a very cushy style. The torch is making its way around the world, and it will be in London this weekend, and then it will be in Paris right before it comes to San Francisco. It's traveling on a chartered plane. It has 10 flame attendants making sure that the flame isn't extinguished. It stays in.
Wait. It stays lit on the plane?
Well, they on the plane, this is all very, very well engineered, and they've come up with a sort of lantern almost, a way to enclose the flame on board flights. So, and then it gets to these cities and it stays in nice hotels before its appearance here.
Not bad. A lot of history and a lot of tradition.
Yes.
Reporter Kelly Wilkinson on the Olympics watch this week for us. Thanks, Kelly.
My pleasure.
And by the way, if you go to the Olympic torch relay in San Francisco next week and you bring a camera, we'd love to see your photos. Just go to californiareport.org and add them to our Flickr pool. Well, on Tuesday, a day before the Olympic torch relay, there will be a Tibetan Freedom Torch ceremony and rally in San Francisco. The majority of California's Tibetan community live in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's the country's third largest Tibetan population after New York City and Minneapolis. And as you can imagine, there's growing concern and activism on their part, as Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Every night for the past 3 weeks, Tibetans have gathered for a vigil in downtown Berkeley. One recent evening, there were about 300 people holding Tibetan flags and cups with tea lights glowing inside. Community leaders offered prayers and talked about logistics for upcoming Olympic torch protests. The vigil started spontaneously after violence broke out in Tibet last month and have been growing ever since.
Our community is really small, and if someone finds out something, everyone knows about it.
That's Lobsang, a 20-something from Richmond who works in real estate. He says he has come every night to the vigil for peace and autonomy in his homeland. Like many in the crowd, he wears a yellow jersey with the word Rongzen, or freedom in the Tibetan language.
Living here for us, this is the least we can do, come out and support. You don't get shot or you don't get taken in a van, and you know your family never hears of you if you do this in the U.S. It's not the case.
Lobsang immigrated to the Bay Area about 10 years ago with his family. That's a common story in this crowd. A special act of Congress resettled 1,000 Tibetans throughout the U.S. in the early 1990s. The legislation passed after the Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, won the Nobel Peace Prize, bringing attention to his people's plight under Chinese rule. Many immigrants brought family over, and the community grew. Tsering Girme is secretary of the Tibetan Association of Northern California.
Basically, Tibetans here are very close-knit. They're very close to each other, especially during the past few weeks since the Chinese started crackdown on Tibetans, you know.
He says ever since that crackdown, Tibetans have been hungry for news. He says they've gotten some information from the Tibetan government and exile sources, but the Chinese government has tried to block communication with the outside world.
For a few weeks, there weren't any international press or media inside Tibet, but during that time we still got messages that, you know, one of Tibetan monks starved because of, you know, they didn't have any food. The Chinese military cut off their electricity line, water, food, everything, and they just surrounded the monastery. So inside they are just dying, you know.
Tibetans here say reaching relatives and friends by phone is difficult, often impossible. Richmond resident Tsering Danakzang knows. He left his parents, three brothers, and three sisters in Tibet when he was forced to flee after distributing some of the Dalai Lama's writings. Danakzang walked for 21 days over the Himalayas to escape.
But the really scary thing is, like, we lost one day in the snow. That's like we walked 3 days in the snow. We ended up in the same area. That was the really scary part. I thought, okay.
Today in Berkeley, Danakzang wears a knit cap with a Tibet flag design over his long black ponytail. In this small office the community rents until it can buy a place of its own, Danakzang says the last time he spoke to his family was March 12th. One of his brothers told him they're afraid to go out since Chinese soldiers are ordered to tear gas any group of three or more people in the street.
So he said we kind of like stuck in the home, and luckily, we have a lot of tambas and foods. That's the last time I talked to them. He just gave the phone to my mom, but she couldn't talk. She couldn't talk. She just cried all the time.
Danakzang has tried calling many times since then, but there's always a recording saying he dialed a non-working number. He says in light of reports about monasteries being cut off by the Chinese, he is particularly worried about one brother who is a monk.
I have no idea what he's going through. And I just like crossing my finger he's alive.
The mood at the nightly vigil reflects both that somber reality and hope. Tibetan leaders like Tsering Gyurme see the Olympic torch events as the perfect vehicle to rally support for the ongoing struggle in their homeland.
It's a bittersweet kind of experience, but it's nice to see that, you know, whenever we have sad things happening in Tibet, that, okay, yeah, we have a community outside that's standing in solidarity with our suffering people in Tibet.
In the next few days, that community here will swell. Over 4,000 Tibetans from throughout the U.S. and Canada are coming to the Bay Area to protest the Olympic torch. Organizers say it will be one of the largest gatherings of Tibetans in North America ever. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornholm.
And now, big hopes for a very small athlete. Yon Silva from Sacramento is only 6 years old, but already he plays tennis better than most of us can ever hope to. And he's getting better every day. That's because his family left California for France so Yon could train full-time at one of the world's premier tennis academies. From Paris, Renee Gattel reports.
At 3'11", Yon Silva can barely see over the net, but he can return any lob that comes his way. Here at the Mouratoglou Tennis Academy in Thiverfal-Grignon, France, he has daily private lessons with some of the best tennis instructors in the world.
What are you practicing right now?
My forehand.
Your forehand?
Yeah. I don't know how to explain, but I know what it is. It's a stroke.
Thiverfal-Grignon is a postcard-perfect village about 20 miles outside Paris, with centuries-old stone buildings tucked amid rolling hills. The tennis school, by contrast, is a sleek, state-of-the-art campus. During the winter, the outdoor courts are covered in giant white tents called bubbles.
Firm wrist.
Yon Silva's dad, 38-year-old Scott Silva, is sitting here on the sidelines of one of the courts, watching his son practice. The racket is almost the same height as Yon. From the baseline, Yon is returning all the serves his coach sends over.
He started beating me about a year ago. And it was quite embarrassing, so I stopped. I stopped playing.
Yon's dad Scott is a former welfare officer for Sacramento County, and his mother was a tennis instructor. Scott says before Yon could even talk, he was already showing signs of a gift for tennis. When he was younger, he took him to see Andre Agassi when he played in Sacramento.
Andre Agassi's playing a match in front of us, and Yanni would sit there for, at 6 months, 7 months old, he would sit there and just watch Andre Agassi play a whole set. Like, you know, most kids his age would be crying and all over the place, but he was into the match.
He was also mesmerized when his mom took him to her tennis lessons. He'd spend hours watching her play, as well as watching tennis on television. Barely able to stand on his own, Yon started hitting foam tennis balls at age one. The rest is history. A videotape of him playing when he was three began circulating in tennis circles, and eventually Yon caught the eye of Patrick Mouratoglou. He invited the Silvas to come visit his school in France and then made them an irresistible offer. Free enrollment for Yon and for his brother Caden, and free room and board and jobs for his parents. In exchange, if Yon one day becomes a tennis pro, he'll owe Mouratoglou a cut of his earnings. Mouratoglou says he's never seen a player so talented at Yon's age.
He's self-confident, he's in advance on his age, and the racket is a part of his body. He doesn't have a racket at the end, in his hand, he has just another part of his body. It's completely natural what he's doing with his racket.
With more than a year in France under his belt, he speaks French better than his parents. After his daily tutoring, he has 2 hours of tennis and then an hour of physical therapy. His story isn't without controversy. Silva's parents have been accused of pushing him too hard, putting too much pressure on the young boy. On online tennis forums, critics say a six-year-old should be allowed to play and have fun, not be groomed to become a champion. But his father Scott says what detractors don't understand is at the heart of it all, Yon is having fun.
It's easy to just sit back someplace, you know, and read our story or see us on television and say, you know, those parents are living their lives to their kids. But when they come here and they meet us, when people actually meet us, they leave saying that, you know, this kid is really happy. The direction this is heading is like a It's like there's no limits to what could happen with this whole situation.
Ask Jan himself what he likes about tennis, and he'll give you the kind of answer any six-year-old might.
I don't know.
Tell me what you like about living in France.
Because the tennis courts are right next to my house, and I get to play with one of my friends. Just what I'm gonna do when he gets back from school.
Do you like playing tennis as much as you do?
Yep.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
Maybe a scientist.
And his parents say that's okay. His dad, Scott, says the day Jan says he's done with tennis, he'll hang up the racket. But until then, it's back to the courts. Hey, Annie. For the California Report, I'm Renee Gattel in Thiva-Val-Grignon, France.
And to see Jan Silva in action on the court, just go to our website, californiareport.org. So did you notice anything different at the top of our show today? Okay, time's up. It's the music. New theme music. Yeah, we decided it was time to give ourselves a new sound. So we turned to a couple of composers in Los Angeles, Willie Aaron and Joey Peters. Joey's band has toured with groups like R.E.M. and Smashing Pumpkins. Willie has performed with artists like Ricky Lee Jones and Dave Alvin. Their musical writing credits include TV shows like the HBO series Rome, Freshman Diaries on Showtime, and the film The Confession, just to name a few. Willie, Joey,
yes.
Good to have you.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here, Scott.
So Willie, let me start with you. Let me just ask you, when you first sat down to write this, you know, blank piece of paper, how did you approach it?
I think when I first sat down to work on it, I wanted something that had some freshness and some effervescence, something that just had a kind of a forward propulsion and that kept the listener engaged from the first beat.
Joey, how about you?
Willie and I sort of kept going back to these kind of same statements, which was we needed a piece of music that would work with this show, which has a very strong character. We wanted the music to be simple, memorable, and like emotionally, it can't be too heavy-handed. It can't be too happy. It can't be too sad.
This is the California Report. If it had been, you know, the Arkansas Report or the Vermont Report, would it have had a very different sound?
Well, Arkansas would have definitely had banjo and
fiddles.
Vermont. Vermont would have had maple syrup, no doubt. But I think it really became about what are you saying in those opening eight bars, and how do you say that and make it sound unique and an original idea, and kind of all those parameters had to be taken into consideration.
We've been kind of whistling and humming it, waiting to finally get it on the air today. So I guess that's a good sign.
Success.
Yeah. That's great.
That's Willie Aaron and Joey Peters. They live in L.A., and they composed our new theme music here on the California Report. Tell us and them what you think about it. You can send your comments to calreport@kqed.org. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Scott.
And finally today, it's said that across that small world, coffee is the second most consumed beverage after water. But for baristas, experts in making espresso drinks, coffee is second to none. 35 of the very best baristas from California and Hawaii faced off in Berkeley last weekend at the Western Regional Barista Competition. Reporter Lisa Morehouse went to see what all the buzz was about.
The aroma of coffee wafts out of the Gaia Art Center in downtown Berkeley, drawing people in.
One of the things that I found with this coffee, and I'm not sure if you tasted it too, there's a little bit of a tomato bisque quality to it.
Like once inside the event, visitors don't hear the typical coffee talk.
Savoriness.
Not with the citrus, but I think that kind of acidity is in both things.
Lisa Suela and David Latrell aren't competing today. They're among several hundred people here attending workshops, sampling different roasts, and cheering on the baristas. In 15-minute time slots, each competitor must prepare 4 espressos, 4 cappuccinos, and 4 signature drinks. A panel of sensory judges scores the beverages on taste and tactile balance, and 2 technical judges evaluate the barista's cleanliness and consistency. 25-year-old Kyle Glanville recently opened Intelligentsia Cafe in Los Angeles. He's up next. Event host John Laird gives a play-by-play of Glanville's performance.
He's working on his espresso now. He's interacting briefly with the technical judges, showing him the coffee so that they can see that visually it's correct.
He skillfully tops his cappuccinos with a traditional rosetta design. Large screen TVs let the audience watch his every move.
What you got is a whole bunch of people here who are just passionately enthusiastic about coffee, and they know what he's going through right now with the pressure.
Glanville ends with his signature drink. Toasted macadamia nuts, brown sugar, and cardamom pods simmer in heavy cream. He adds espresso and strains the mixture into a martini glass and finishes with a whisper of vanilla ice cream.
30 seconds remaining.
It's so nerdy, and like so many, you know, competitive baristas, you know, drinking beer, will get into debates about, you know, grinder on the right side or grinder on the left side, and various other things that, you know, most people would consider to be absolutely trivial, but we obsess over it.
Glanville prepared for this competition for months, but he's humble about his role in making great coffee.
I love being a barista, and, you know, I'll be a barista till the day I die, I hope. It's also important to realize that we're one link in the chain. And actually, the most important factor in quality in the cup is that the farmers are selecting only the ripest cherries.
Glanville's passion served him well. He placed second in the competition.
Double espresso?
The champion, Chris Baca, is back at work at Ritual Roasters in San Francisco just days after winning top honors. He thinks the judges connected with his Brazilian coffee and with him.
That's my philosophy. Showcase the coffee and make everybody laugh.
Baca's specialty drink, a cherry lime cheesecake beverage, brought out the flavors he picked up on in the bean.
So we're doing two things. We're going to add air and add temperature to this milk.
And in Ritual's basement and training grounds, Baca uses his skills to teach the next generation of top-notch baristas. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
But you can't, there's rules to when you can do things. Mm-hmm. So adding air.
And for a link to pictures of the competition and its live blog, visit our website, www.californiareport.org. And that's our caffeinated show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, and Leanne Lucetta. The producer is Victoria Malione. Pat Flynn edited our story on the Tibetans. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a swell weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.